Go. Hi, my name is Renee Ridson. I'm from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, where my responsibilities include working on the foundation-funded work on non-vaccine HIV prevention. I'm delighted to be a part of this important symposium and actually to be a part of an increased attention and look at prevention in these conferences. I want to acknowledge Gita Ramji for putting this session together. Thank you very much. I think this is an important session. We have several large-scale phase 3 HIV prevention trials finishing up and ongoing in the field right now. These trials are teaching us many lessons, are proving to be exceedingly more complex and expensive than anyone anticipated, with challenges of lower expected incidence and higher than expected pregnancy rates, requiring product to be stopped, a decreased retention, and many other challenges, which has necessitated a very good look at how these trials need to proceed. And so hopefully we will have some important information, observation, and lessons in this session. I would like to introduce my co-chair, Mitchell Warren, who is the executive director of the AIDS Vaccine Advocacy Coalition. They're doing a lot of advocacy around vaccines, but also around other non-vaccine prevention interventions. And the facilitator for this afternoon is Kim Dixon from WHO, who's been working on microbicides and male circumcision. I would like to introduce Mitchell at this point, who will make introduction of the first couple of speakers.
Great. Thanks very much, Renee. And it is tremendously exciting for a number of reasons, both in terms of content, but also in terms of friendship. One of the nice things is, challenging as this field is, there are a lot of great people working in it and a great deal of collegiality. And it's my great pleasure to introduce first and foremost Qureisha Abdul-Karim, with whom I personally had the chance to work for many years when we didn't talk about research as much as we talked about actually preventing new infections. And it's been an evolving piece of work in her own career in South Africa and internationally. She currently is the Associate Scientific Director of the Center for the AIDS Program of Research in South Africa, better known to many of you as CAPRISA, and is also the co-PI of the HPTN, the HIV Prevention Trial Network Leadership Group, the NIH-funded leadership group. So I'm going to turn it over to Qureisha, who is going to talk about current challenges in HIV prevention research.
Thanks very much, Mitchell, for that warm introduction. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I sort of feel at a very distinct disadvantage here. My body is here, and my mind is telling me something else, like, you know, it should be sleep time or something. But anyways, it gives me, I want to thank the organizers for the opportunity to address you. I had a letter of invitation that gave me one title, and then I saw the program, so I tried to mix a little bit of some of the prevention challenges with some of the research challenges, so hopefully this works. If not, I'm sure between Ward, Andrew, and Veronica, there'll be some compensation. So in terms of my presentation this afternoon, I want to talk very briefly about the evidence pyramid, some of the prevention challenges, if you needed any convincing that prevention actually does work, and then some of the timeline for the current prevention trials, and then the issue of getting research into policy and practice, indeed a complex phenomenon. So, Mitchell and I were chatting a little bit about, we've been hearing repeatedly over the course of this conference and in other settings about the need for evidence. And I wanted to share briefly this evidence pyramid, where the value, least valued of evidence is that of expert opinion. And some people, you know, if you like what they're saying, then expert opinion counts very highly. But seriously, in terms of good understanding of what is making a difference, does an intervention work or not, the randomized controlled trial is about the best evidence you can get for informing policy and practice. And then beyond the individual randomized controlled trials, meta-analyses of multiple randomized controlled trials through systematic reviews, etc. So here, in terms of knowledge generation, you can have expert opinion. Moving on to in vitro research, animal research, case series and case reports, case control studies, cohort studies, and then evidence sufficient to design and implement a randomized controlled trial, and from there on, systematic reviews. So in terms of prevention challenges more broadly, I think one of the first issues is that we're not dealing with one simple pandemic, but what we are dealing with is a complex mosaic of multiple epidemics that are diverse in terms of modes of transmission, but also in terms of burden of disease. So when we're thinking prevention and we're thinking about effective prevention, we can't be thinking about one solution to eradicating HIV, if we get to be that lucky. But certainly in our response, knowledge of the epidemic is really an important starting point. From there on, identifying the target populations that would benefit and what is the most effective interventions to target at those groups. So an additional challenge that we have in terms of prevention is there's a fair amount of scientific uncertainty in terms of transmission, in terms of replication, etc. But one of the bigger ones facing us in terms of doing prevention research is that we have no surrogate markers of protection. And at this time, the most reliable marker we have is HIV infection of uninfected people. So in the context of this huge amount of scientific uncertainty, we at the same time have a parallel imperative, a public health imperative, to respond to the epidemic. And this has been a tension over many years, is how much more basic science do we need before we act, and what is the balance between knowledge that we derive in terms of basic science, clinical science, and then implementation and design of interventions. That's not one that's easily resolved, and this debate continues today, and we see it particularly in terms of microbicide trials. We see that with vaccine trials, but also in light of the more recent trial data that was released in terms of MIRA and the early closure of the cellulose sulfate trials. And I'm sure it's something that we'll continue to discuss and debate. And those debates and discussions, as far as they are constructive, will move us forward. But there is no right answer about how much basic science do we need to have before we proceed to testing these interventions in clinical trials. The knowledge generation process in terms of, in the context of HIV, is a lot more complex. As scientists working in other areas, we're used to sitting in our labs or offices or wherever it is we do our research and quietly getting on with what we need to do. Most of the world is not interested in what are the outcomes of stem cell research or something as esoteric as that. But with AIDS having such an immediate impact, public opinion matters, public need for information, public need for accountability and transparency in decision-making is really quite unprecedented in the context of the HIV/AIDS epidemic and our responses to that. And this need for information flow, communication of ideas, not what we usually do, which is publish our paper through a peer review process and then discuss it, has really led to some novel ways of science or knowledge generation. Particularly, I want to highlight the synergy that has evolved between science and activism. I think more recently what we're seeing is the emergence of politics and media as I won't call them confounders, but new challenges in the way we do research. And I think that transformation of those two other players in the way we do research is one that needs to develop and be refined a lot more to take the science forward as opposed to paralyzing science, which has, or sensationalizing science. And lastly, that HIV/AIDS is more than a medical issue. And I think most of us sitting here understand its development context, its need for a multi-sectoral approach, and that if we're going to be effective, we need to partner with a whole lot of people that we don't usually partner when doing biomedical or medical research. One of the newer challenges that I actually see it as an opportunity is with increasing access to antiretroviral treatment, what we're seeing is the integration of prevention and care. And this is while it is an evolving and emerging opportunity for improving prevention efforts, to date there have been few successful sustained efforts to integrate prevention into care programs. And prevention interventions have traditionally concentrated on protecting those at risk of infection. And this integration of prevention with care demands a refocus and an expansion of prevention efforts to target those already infected. To date, we have very few new models in this regard, but these are starting to emerge. And I think this is one of the newer and more exciting developments. To move on to what evidence that prevention works. So I think quite often when the UNAIDS data is released, we are, we're just not succeeding. And the reality is that there are countries, and here we have Uganda, I won't go through the details of that, we have Thailand with its 100% condom promotion program, and we have this country where we all gathered, Australia, that have really shown the way in terms of country-level responses with leadership, with multi-sectoral approaches, knowing the details of the epidemic, targeting the interventions at the groups to benefit most, have been able to demonstrate with very limited prevention options, behavior change, condom promotion, VCT, injecting supportive harm reduction interventions, that you can make a difference at a country level to epidemic trajectories. But the reality in most parts of the world is that we have failed to scale up prevention. And this slide is a little bit dated, but it gives you some clue and indication of how unsuccessful we have been to target these known interventions to the level, to the magnitude, and to those who need to benefit most. Okay. So this, I fidgeted so many times with this particular slide because as I prepared for this talk, more trial results became available, and I think we've all been very disappointed with what we've been hearing and seeing on the one hand. But on the other hand, I think also that for each of these trials that have not given us the outcome we want, we've had other important, valuable lessons, and the other speakers in the panel will be addressing it. But this just gives you some idea, color-coded microbicide trials, barrier methods, behavior, treatment, PMTCT vaccines, what a long road we have ahead, and anything can happen. For example, we have the MIRA trial results, moved on, hearing about it earlier, but negative. But we're learning a whole bunch of other things. That's the important piece. And if we had the answer already, there would be no need for these trials. That's the important thing to remember. And a lot of this is really the public sector investments. All of the trials we're seeing here are really all of the trials occurring. And I think that's a sad indictment in terms of the prevention research field, in terms of investments other than vaccines for shorter timeline interventions to alter the epidemic trajectories. I want to turn very briefly to some of these trials, and as these results come out, they all have certain things in common with the exception of some of the vaccine trials, which is that they require some kind of chronic use of the intervention or medication in otherwise healthy and uninfected persons. And the second is an increase in health systems focus in terms of these prevention interventions. Also, the importance of knowledge of HIV status and some concern as we have many partially effective or many new interventions. When you introduce a new intervention, it's going to lead to migration from other methods. So as we think about this, as we await these trial results, one of the things we need to start thinking about is getting research into policy and practice. And I want to dwell a little bit in terms of what are the lessons we have learned to date a couple of experiences that may inform the scale-up of these new trial findings as and when they emerge. The first lesson is that from scaling up antiretroviral treatment access, and they highlight lots of issues, but in particular issues around politics and capacity and how that impacts on policy formulation and programmatic scale-up. The issue of promotion of knowledge of HIV status beyond a client-initiated one to provider-initiated, all kinds of other permutations, other sessions in this conference will deal with, but particularly a human rights dimension that's highlighted. The issue of introducing the female condom and particularly migration from other methods and also ethical issues, and then male circumcision trials. So this is a Palela diagram in terms of impact of mortality with introduction of antiretroviral treatment in industrialized countries, served as a huge impetus for scaling up antiretroviral treatment access in resource-constrained settings, has led to some laudable interventions, PEPFAR, the Global Fund for AIDS, TB, and malaria, etc. But what is the reality? The reality in Africa, for example, is there's been a slow scaling up of antiretroviral treatment. And if you focus on the last line,
it's the other way. You know, it was shining on you.
Okay. So I've displayed my technophobic tray. If you look at the total, there are just over 3 million people who need to be on treatment. This and about 351,000 on treatment, representing less than 10%. In large parts of Africa, there were concerns people don't own clocks, so they won't be able to adhere to medication. I think there's lots of data that have come out to show that's the least of our concerns. Adherence, in fact, in Africa exceeds much of what we're seeing in industrialized countries. But one of the bigger bottlenecks besides the political obfuscation in some of our countries has been the shortage of healthcare personnel. Healthcare services in Africa are struggling to cope with the additional burden of AIDS care. We have overworked and stressed staff. Deborah Work mentioned that this morning. There are also concerns about accidental HIV exposure leading to low morale, given the high HIV burden that we see and limited barrier method access, etc. But importantly, Africa doesn't just have AIDS as a problem. It has many, many health problems. And what AIDS is doing is taking away some very limited resources away from other care. And this has to shift. This balance needs to get back so that we don't address the AIDS issue and then find we're lagging behind. And we're already seeing that with our immunization coverage rates are low. We're looking at female mortality going down, infant mortality rates going up. Some of that is AIDS-related. Some of it is about other care being compromised with the increasing focus. And while there's a dire and humanitarian need to scale up antiretroviral treatment access, there's some balance here that needs to be reached. And for many years, again, a point Deborah made this morning, is for years we've been struggling to retain our skilled healthcare professionals. A very well-kept secret in Africa is that our biggest export is healthcare workers. So you go around the world, you see people trained in Africa who are nurses, pharmacists, clinicians, etc. And just to give you one example, over the last 35 years at the University of Witwatersrand in South Africa, 44% of their graduates have emigrated. And most of the medical or healthcare worker training is done with public sector funds. So this is public sector funds subsidizing export of skills to other parts of the world. This is a serious issue that needs to be addressed. Okay, we all know that knowledge of HIV status is an important gateway both for prevention and for treatment. Huge amounts of stigma, real or perceived, has been a huge bottleneck for people seeking to know their HIV status. Some of it has also been the models of BCT provision that we have. And I emphasize BCT. because this has been shown repeatedly as an important component and dimension for testing. We do now have evidence from countries that have chosen to go with just testing, and we've seen very little impact of that particular mode of HIV testing in terms of uptake of testing, as well as the impact of knowledge of HIV status. Here we have several examples of trials underway or interventions at an ecological level. For example, family-based VCT in Uganda has made an enormous difference over an 18-month period, increasing knowledge of HIV status from about 18% to greater than 84%. And many people now who know the epidemic from the early 90s attribute this as one of the more important interventions in terms of altering the epidemic trajectory in Uganda. In Kenya, we have good examples of provider-initiated VCT, in Lesotho, universal HIV testing with VCT, and then a trial, a very exciting trial in South Africa at the moment on community-based one, which is really one of the few structural-level interventions to promote knowledge of HIV status. So I want to focus now on female condoms in prevention programs. Unfortunately, the Brazilian government, when they decided to introduce the female condom, sort of anticipate those naysayers that say when you introduce something new, people would migrate from other things. So they tried different permutations where they introduced the female condom in the community through healthcare settings and then randomized some communities to get a combined community and healthcare intervention. And what you see uniformly here is contrary to popular belief that when you introduce something new in a setting, you actually increase the number of protected coital acts compared to when you just have a single intervention. And I think this is really important because our goal is not to promote one intervention or the other. We need a panoply of interventions. And here, introducing new interventions actually increases the probability of exposure to the virus in discordant sexual acts in this particular case. Now I'm turning to male circumcision. And Mitchell said this, and I'm going to say it again. I think you're going to hear it over and over again. This is one of the best pieces of good news that we've had in almost a decade. And not only good news from the Orange Farm data, which became available just over 2 years ago, but consistent data from the Rakai study trial and also Kisumu. So if you think in terms of the evidence pyramid that I started off with, you can't get better than this. Three randomized controlled trials, all with the consistent data. And what more do we need? I mean, this is very clear that male circumcision is an opportunity to impact on HIV trajectories in low circumcision countries with high prevalence, HIV prevalence. It involves consenting adult men. Some of the discourse gets conflated with what about adolescents, what about infants, what about rights, what about culture. But the trials are very specific. They were all conducted in adult consenting men. We're not extrapolating the data beyond that. These are settings where male circumcision is not common. And here is an opportunity to integrate safe male circumcision with other sexual and reproductive health services for men. We keep hearing about the vulnerability of women in countries where women are vulnerable. Men who have power and have the ability to make decisions have not been taking the responsibility or making those decisions. So here is a wonderful opportunity to change that for promoting greater male responsibility, but importantly, modeling data saying that it could reduce incidence in adult men by 50 to 60%. So we've had an unprecedented rapid recommendation on scaling up from WHO, UNAIDS, but there still is some lack of consensus in the scientific community. There's also ambivalence to make policy decisions at a country level and also mixed feelings in other quarters. So to summarize, translating RCT findings to policy and practice is complex, partly because HIV/AIDS is more than a health issue, and we've learned over the years that social mobilization is a very effective tool. This is something as scientists we don't think about much more, but there's certainly evidence from the country level interventions of how significant and important an impact social mobilization has. that we also know that RCT evidence is not sufficient for policy formulation. It's important as we think about and prepare for some of the trials findings that was in the timeline, that we need to start strengthening healthcare delivery systems. We also need to be thinking of combination interventions, food testing that combine biomedical and behavioral or social interventions to have a more substantive impact on the pandemic, even as we think about access issues and design of new trials. We need to address stigma and discrimination to promote uptake of HIV testing. It's one of the few hopes we have with increasing access to treatment that we can have a more classic infectious disease impact on this epidemic by dealing both with those infected and uninfected and at risk and those recently infected. And that I think what we have some evidence for, and I'm sure increasing as the number of interventions we have increase, is that the concern that the introduction of new intervention will lead to migration of known and available interventions is misplaced. Indeed, we need a panoply of options to address the complex and diverse pandemic and its challenges it poses to us. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Karisha. Our intent is to engage in a dialogue after all four presenters. I will open it for any questions of clarification. Seeing none, we will move to our next presenter. I don't see any, truly. Okay, I really don't. Next, it's my great pleasure to introduce a great friend and colleague, Ward Cates. I think for any of us that work in this field, we know that there are, if we don't know there are going to be setbacks and challenges, we're in the wrong line of work. And in my darkest, most cynical days, I'm always just able to look at Ward and remember that there's optimism in this field because he keeps us all optimistic. And that's true of his days at the Centers for Disease Control and for the last several years, many years, running programs at Family Health International. So I'll turn it over to you, Ward, to talk about the optimist view, which I did not know was your title when I said those things about you. That's incredible.
Well, I knew that you were going to introduce me, Mitchell, so I couldn't resist this particular title. Wow. It takes one to know one. And truly, this is a time, even with discouraging results from trials, to be optimistic about what we've learned from them about stronger future trials, and that's going to be the bottom line. Now, all of us seem to have this rainbow series, whether it's Mitchell's or whether it's Karisha's, whether it's Kate Hankins, whether it's Veronica's, but this is one that I've been using to just show when we might have anticipated trial results, including one even today regarding acyclovir for both acquisition and infectiousness, or at least shedding in poster prevention 011. So we have had both late-breaking news and so on, and we have to keep in mind that the past decade have brought two new biomedical approaches, whether it be nevirapine or whether it be male circumcision, as Karisha pointed out. And we've really had 10 valuable lessons learned about how to do the trials that we're talking about awaiting the results for. And these are just my sort of breakdown of the 10, Ward's 10 top lessons. But because of timing and so, I'm going to only focus on five of those. Some of them were touched upon at a macroscopic viewpoint by Karisha. Now, adherence is the most crucial aspect of all of our prevention trials. We've learned about the role of social desirability bias in terms of the self-reports that we get, not matching up at least with the objective biologic results we get when we test it. So we've really learned by having some new approaches to try and improve our accuracy, whether they're computer-assisted ACOSI methods, whether there's some applicator testing that I'll show you in a moment, whether they're MEMS packets, those are two packets to see if pills are actually dispersed. Both of those talk about the applicator or the packaging, doesn't actually tell you about the actual use. But then there's drug levels with sort of spot checks of whether urine or blood of at particular visits, PSA or Y chromosomes to look for sexual activity, unprotected sexual activity, and then a creative approach, directly observed adherence or directly observed prevention that's being planned for future studies. And finally, we've even redesigned counseling messages during the course of trials when we started saying that the type of adherence in specific groups that we wanted was not happening. Well, a couple of examples. I personally think this is one of the real five top breakthroughs in the microbicide field that we've had, and it happens to be with at least a measure of adherence by the POP Council group in their Caragard study. These are the applicators. What you do is they ask that the applicators are brought back. A very inexpensive blue dye is applied to the tip, run underwater. If the applicators were not used, look to the left. You'll see some clear applicator tips. If they were used, you'll see some residual blue dye. Now, some have been skeptical as whether or not that assay can be used, can be validated, number one, and used in the field. Just published a month ago, Andrea Wallace and her council crew did studies in a very tightly controlled clinical setting in the United States and actually found for both true insertion and true non-insertion high levels of accuracy. And that same methodology played out when it was done in the actual trial settings of Caragard, which indicates that if future trials want to use this, either as a spot check or as a continued check for their applicators, it is one way to add at least an indicator to complement the self-reports. Then in terms of reinforced counseling, within the HPTN 035, we found in early on in the study that there was sort of a concordancy that those who were more likely to use condoms were also more likely to use gel when they use condoms. And at discordancy, to some extent, if you want to think of it, that without condoms, those were also less likely to use gel. Now, this far right-hand column is the column we want to enhance most. It's those who are not using condoms that we want to most use gel. The counseling messages were changed, and over the course of time, over the course of about 20 months, at least the self-reports, and again, the skeptics are saying social desirability bias, but the self-reports showed an increase in terms of use of gel in those last acts in which condoms weren't used. So there have been creative approaches to the question of adherence, and there'll be even more as we go forward in the future. This is crucial. What about the prevention standard of care? And I want to read from you from a wonderful document that Mitchell, Kate, and others have put forth called Good Participatory Practice. And one of the essential principles of good participatory practice is a standard of prevention that says researchers, research site staff, and trial sponsors have an ethical responsibility to ensure that appropriate risk reduction counseling and access to proven HIV prevention methods. And the emphasis there is on proven. So what are our traditional approaches for counseling people as our prevention standard of care? Well, number one, there is this reinforcing prevention counseling for which the evidence is somewhat there if you look at the Explorer trial, but I would not say it's that strong as far as level one evidence. There's provision of male condoms for which we have no level one evidence because it's unethical to do actually a randomized trial with male condoms, but we provide those. And we give STI treatment. Now, these are traditional, for which there's one level one and four level one, four that is positive, four level ones that show no effect. Now, are these proven interventions? We use them, and they may even work. Horatia brought up the female condom, for which there is biologic plausibility, and for which increasingly in some of our trials, those have been also included as our standard prevention standard of care package. And then the male circumcision results, which are incontrovertible, how do we get those into our prevention standard of care? Well, there is some evidence that these trials are interventions of their own. And I had shown for years the evidence from Ron Roddy's Cameroon film trial, which showed at least using limited pretrial estimates, relatively high incidence levels in the population being studied, had during the trial, and then in a couple of follow-up studies, shown that it stayed relatively low or even lower afterwards. Well, in Kenya, Elizabeth Ngugi just published in JADES her results from her Nairobi female sex worker cohort in the early part of the millennium that had also the same sort of trend data in terms of incidents during the trial and even after the trial, with rather minimal continued community intervention and peer support. So it is sort of interesting that the trial itself, whether it's because of a selection phenomena for those who choose to participate in trials and continue to get reinforced during the trial, but there is some evidence that these trials themselves are interventions, prevention standard of care. But what about male circumcision? This is now what we're wrestling with in doing the future trials. Not only counseling patients, but what must we offer to all participants if we're doing a prevention trial of men and recruiting uncircumcised men, or if we're doing prevention trials in women and they have uncircumcised partners, is it at least as protective for the women as a preventive standard of care to offer to circumcise their partners as it is to offer the male or female condoms? Think of it. Level one evidence on one hand. Okay, and then how else do we handle this in the analysis? And then how will it actually affect our study validity? Now going to be some fun part, which I thought, how was I going to present anything new to this audience of this people that I talk with weekly? And so I thought what we would do is to present some cost elements across some of these trials, because it is, as Horatia said, expensive to do these trials, and we have to learn, just like we're learning lessons in methodology, we have to learn lessons of costs. And then there's the fact of what is planned, what are the budgets we put in and get some of the people sitting in this audience to say yes to, and then what does it actually cost once we do the trial. And then there are whole elements of sequencing, where how much does it cost before the trial begins? I can get there. Okay. How much during the trial, and then how much after the trial, which frequently isn't even built in to the typical study estimate. And this is just the operations timeline that it shows what we could sort of count as total trial costs, but frequently what we talk about are the cost from first participant in to last participant out, just to show you the cost considerations. But it's much more than that. And this is the wonderful layer cake that Kate McQueen designed and has the whole aspects. If you look at the middle layer, that's the typical trial that we would talk about. But when you start adding policy development, advocacy, community elements, acceptability and at different stages, and operations and operations research and implementation, you build a lot more costs into the trial, and it really takes a total village to run these prevention trials right now. Let me just start to wrap up, because Renee is telling you this when I'm halfway through. Okay, but what are the components of these costs? And I'll go through very quickly. It depends upon what are some nested studies. Are there the preparatory studies beforehand? What behavioral laboratory or seroconverters are involved? Are product expenses actually, does the trial itself have to pay for the product, or is this going to be donated? What are the community activities that are going to be built pre, during, and post? Communication support. And then central versus field. We're used to networks where we might have core support for operations, statistical, and laboratory versus site costs in the field, getting to know that. And then monitoring visits. Within, for example, NIH costs, the monitoring visits are not built into the type of budgets that the networks have to provide, because NIH picks that up through PPD. All of these are sort of considerations in trying to compare different costs. So what do we have? Well, these are six microbicide studies labeled anonymously A through F, and these total estimated costs come from the investigators themselves asking me how much did it cost. So there is nothing validated about this. This is more of a qualitative estimate. What I want you to do is look at the column from the second from the right and then the far right, that there is not only a huge range of the total estimated costs, even in our microbicide trials, with some difference in number of participants and lots of difference in number of endpoints. But we have a range of cost per participant from very low to very high, but, or I shouldn't say from very low to very high, from low to slightly higher. We also have very interesting ranges that are not even necessarily correlated with a cost per participant, which is a cost per endpoint. And I'm just showing you that because of the range of costs as we're starting to zero in on what is really what we should budget for these trials. Now, I want to show a good news story. Remember, circumcision is a great news in terms of its scientific validity. When you look at trials A, B, and C for the circumcision trials, and you look at cost per participant and cost per endpoint, there's some variability, but it's much lower than, and I just showed microbicides, I could show any of the other non-circumcision trials, and they'd all be in the exact same ballpark as microbicides. But so what is the summary of our cost effort, if I can get this thing to move there? Okay. First of all, there are many components. What I've just shown you is really comparing apples and oranges, which produces a wide range of estimates. The cost per participant factor is most necessary for budgeting trials. Those are the number of people that you have to plan on seeing. But the cost per endpoint is actually the most important for determining effectiveness in the trial and something we're going to have to keep in mind. And then the best buy is, of course, male circumcision at all levels, as a scientific consistency, as a cost per trial, and as a scale-up. Well, I have two others that I was going to go into, but we're short of time, and they've already been partially covered. I'm just going to hold this down and go through these as quickly as we can here. But it has to do with community engagement. It doesn't go as fast as I'd like it to, Renee. I'm trying. I just want you to know that. Okay. But anyway, there are multiple communities. We've talked about research literacy for the community, research and community literacy for researchers. You've heard several of us talk about this before. We have to start it early, set aside our resources, and extend beyond local community. And though we've had great, well-meaning efforts at formative research and it's moved trials ahead, it's necessary but not sufficient. This is about how you do train. This is one curriculum that FHI has done for research ethics. I show you the good participatory practice guidelines that WHO, Mitchell, and others have put together. And then there's the communications planning, as we've learned. The fastest thing to stop a trial is communications that get out of control. We've had to plan for that. We've had to pick sites with established relationships, investigators who are have some ability to intervene, and then practice and practice and prepare and practice when this comes into play. This is Lee Peterson at the Toronto conference giving the final results of the tenofovir trial, actually encouraging at the end, and the most widely cited abstract out of Toronto, and had a good ending. So in conclusion, the research by its nature is going to be evolving all the time. That we're going to have a lot of complexities with lots of lessons learned. Disagreements are going to be common. We have to move ahead. And our current generation, the ones that we're going forward, the future Rainbow series, are on a much stronger methodological foundation and operational foundation than they were before. Thanks.
Ask for clarifying questions.
Thank you so much, Ward. Are there questions for clarification for Ward? All right, that's great. I'll turn it over to Renee.
Thank you, and well done, Ward. Thank you. I'm sorry we were getting a bit late and started. Our next speaker is Dr. Andrew Nunn, who is an investigator from the Microbicide Development Project from the UK MRC. He works on the phase 3 trial examining the microbicide candidate Pro-2000. He is also the associate director for the clinical trials unit for the MRC. And he's going to give us a talk on challenges in microbicide trial design.
Thanks, Renee, and thank you for the opportunity to talk about this subject. As a clinical trialist, I believe that the best trials are very often the large and the simple trials, but I did tend to think that when we started doing trials of microbicides, they would be simple. They are simple in some ways, but I don't think they are simple at all, and indeed the challenges that I want to talk about are the challenges, not the challenges that we might face in the future, but the challenges that we face now. I realize it's not a complete list, and when we come to discussion later on, there will be people who will want to address some of the things perhaps that I haven't mentioned, and indeed the solutions that I might be proposing to some of those challenges will by no means be unique, and indeed some of you may feel you wish to disagree with them. Some of the areas that... It doesn't press very well, does it? That's better. Some of the areas I want to talk about are shown on this slide. I won't go through the slide now, but we'll pick the points up as we go along. I want to begin with the question about biomarkers. How can they help? Well, maybe the question is not so much how can they help, but can they help? Can they provide the information on safety and or efficacy which will enable us to identify a winner? In other words, to make life a little bit easier in our selection of products. Results from current phase 3 trials and those that are finishing right now, whether they have produced positive or negative results, together with the lab data that went before them and the early phase clinical studies, they need to be critically evaluated, and that's going to be so important in order to be able to make an assessment as to whether we can make use of the pre-phase 3 data in our choice of products. Biomarkers are, however, I believe, most likely to help to identify potentially unsafe microbicides, in other words, ones that we don't want to use rather than ones that we do want to use. Horatio has already indicated that there are no surrogates of HIV acquisition. At the end of the day, we have no intermediate marker. As in trials of cancer treatment, for example, where you might look at progression of the tumour as an intermediate as to what is happening, we don't have that luxury. And so, in fact, we are much more likely to be able to eliminate unsuccessful or possibly potentially dangerous products rather than, in fact, pick on ones that we think are going to be very good. We also have to be aware of the fact that markers identified in one class of microbicides cannot be assumed necessarily to be useful in the assessment of new classes. And a word of caution, even if we could accept or reject candidates for phase 3 solely on the basis of activity in vitro and in the macaque studies, the most effective products in these models may not be the safest in the long term. And indeed, activity in these models will not necessarily translate into effectiveness because of biological differences and coital effects and the presence of semen. And probably one of the most important factors of all at the end of the day is the acceptability of the product. And adherence will be critical determinants of effectiveness in women. It's a great relief to us that MDP-301, we are finding the women who are taking part in that study I was so thrilled with the product, they are very disappointed to get to the end of the study and not to be able to continue using it. Not thinking it so much necessarily about whether it's protecting them, but in fact that they're enjoying using it. A word about phase 2b studies. This has been discussed in a number of different arenas. And first of all, the case in favour. Well, of course, it is a way to help us to select if we've got multiple products. We're not in that position right at this present time of having a lot of new products to look at. But it does offer the opportunity to eliminate ineffective products. And should there be amongst that group of products a highly effective one, it could provide us with a fast answer. That, of course, would go with a substantial reduction in cost, but only if no further trials were indicated. If we didn't get a product out of the trial, one thing we would get, of course, would be insights on the design of trial and site preparedness. But the case against is also something we need to think about, because a phase 2b can result in a longer and more costly process at the end of the day, because if we only find a moderately effective microbicide, then our subsequent phase 3 trial will be required. And we run the risk, I believe, in eliminating potentially effective microbicides, which perhaps don't run too well in that early study. And an important consideration I think we do need to think about, and we need to think about this if we are doing a phase 2B at the time we're doing it and not after we've done it. If we get a positive finding, whether statistically significant or not, it could make it more difficult to conduct a pivotal phase 3 trial. Because if we've got to go on and do that trial afterwards, participants and possibly ethics committees might consider it unethical to conduct another placebo-controlled trial if the product has already been shown to have some effect. A long time ago, Erasmus said that prevention is better than cure, and it's something that most of us would agree with. But proving the effectiveness of a preventive therapy is often much harder than proving the effectiveness of a cure. There's a quote from Nancy Padian's paper in The Lancet of just under 2 weeks ago. To date, 25 randomized controlled trials for HIV prevention have reported, and only four have shown a preventive effect. Three trials of circumcision and one trial of treating STIs, whereas 19 showed no effect and two had a potentially deleterious effect. That's where we are right now. It is more difficult to conduct trials of prevention than trials of treatment. If you're assessing treatment, you can target the people that you want to treat. You know who you are looking for, and you can determine from your criteria of eligibility who you want in the study. If, on the other hand, you're doing prevention, you don't really know who are the people that you want to treat, and indeed, you stand a very good chance of perhaps missing them and working on a population where there are very few people, in fact, who actually need your preventive treatment in the first place. And just to make things even more complicated, because of the ethical constraint on us to make sure that we give and deliver good counselling for condom use and so on, it's quite possible, even if we could identify our target population, that they will move off and we will miss them yet again. So there is a real challenge of how we can efficiently conduct a trial when we don't really know who are the people we want to target. Well, one way of doing that, of course, is to study discordant couples. In the HPTN study, and I've probably got the number wrong here, is a placebo-controlled trial which has successfully enrolled nearly 3,500 discordant couples in 14 sub-Saharan African countries to assess whether acyclovir suppression in HSV2 positives reduces the chance of HIV transmission. So it can be done. And indeed, in MDP, we have one of our sites, the site in Masaka in Uganda, which is on target right now to enroll 620 seronegative women whose main partner is an HIV-positive man. There are, of course, pluses and minuses with the case for discordant couple studies. Yes, we have a high incident group. Yes, it could be useful also to evaluate bio-directional effects. We could have a look at, we could see the effect not only on a negative woman from a positive man, but from the other direction as well. But we also need to be aware that when those in the trial become aware of their mutual status on enrollment to the study, that may result in good adherence to study product, but at the same time result in substantially increased condom uptake. And of course, it goes without saying, a study like this requires very large numbers, as both of the two studies I've already referred to have shown. We've already had brief reference made to the idea of DOT. Now, DOT, of course, is something which, in fact, has been shown to work extremely well in the treatment of particularly tuberculosis. And the suggestion has been made that, well, if we wanted to demonstrate proof of concept, not to do this as something which we could deliver as a regular way of doing things, but if we wanted to demonstrate proof of concept, then this could be a way, perhaps one of the most quick, effective ways to do so with microbicides. And this is a study which, in fact, is currently being planned by IPM. He's gone to sleep again. Oh. I wanted to move on to talking about the choice between a short and a long-term follow-up. In MDP, we had a long discussion about whether it would be appropriate to perhaps give a shorter follow-up than we might originally have chosen to do in the design of the study. One of the advantages of a short follow-up is because there is a likelihood that in over time, there will be a loss to follow-up and indeed increased pregnancy rates. That is a real concern, and indeed, adherence is also likely to fall over time. Now, as a trialist, obviously, we're not just concerned that numbers will, in fact, mean that the power of the study may be reduced if, in fact, we have more women dropping out of the study, but also what the results may mean if, in fact, they're limited to a smaller proportion of the total number enrolled. If we had a shorter follow-up, there is the possibility that we have an increased chance to develop, to demonstrate proof of concept. On the other hand, there are disadvantages, because we clearly, again, need to screen and recruit more women, and there will be increased costs to go with that. We will only have short-term data on adverse events, and the data may no longer be useful for licensing purposes, and indeed there will be no data on long-term acceptability or effectiveness. And indeed, as a bottom line, it is possible, and we will only know this when our trials have been completed, that adherence could improve with time. I don't know how I'm doing for time, but whether... how am I doing? We'll do this one very quickly. There's been a discussion amongst a number of researchers recently about the possibility of what we've called a super data and safety monitoring board. To help to enable earlier detection of an adverse outcome, obviously this is a very important concern amongst researchers because, of course, the possibility of increased seroconversions in the treated arm over the placebo is something which could do an awful lot of damage if it occurs. And we want to be able to stop that at an early stage. On the other hand, we won't want to stop it too early. And this is something which could be done without threat to the integrity of the study, and it's important, I believe, to maintain public confidence. It could be done in parallel trials of the same product or in different products of the same class. How would it work? Well, seroconversion data from each of the trials would be sent to an independent center. A program would be run to see whether, in fact, a particular threshold had been crossed. Nobody would be looking at the data. This data would actually go into a computer program. If the threshold was crossed, then that monitoring board would meet to decide whether they need to make recommendations to the individual DSMBs. Pooling data to look at monitor if efficacy is not such a good idea, and I won't go into this slide now, but in fact certainly it's something which is generally frowned upon amongst researchers. So how are we going to improve trial efficacy? I believe one of the most important things is the selection of our population. We need to get populations with fairly high incidence. Some trials have had to close simply because they didn't have incidence which was sufficiently high. If you just look at these figures here, you'll see the difference in the numbers that are required for a study where the incidence rates are only 1 to 2%, and for those where they are perhaps 4 to 5, 4, 5 or 6%. Interestingly, there's very comparatively little difference between the 4 and 5% compared to the 1, 2 and 3%. So they're the sort of figures that we should be aiming for. And it will make a huge difference to the cost of the trial and how long it takes to do it. There are other factors, of course. We need to be able to choose a stable population. We need to consider the option of DOT if we want to show proof of concept, as I've indicated earlier. We need to minimize loss to follow-up, possibly through shortening follow-up duration. Involving male partners is particularly important, and ensuring participants are aware of the commitment that we require of them. We need, and I have to confess this is only just a fleeting mention of that very important area of behavioral data. We need to have a better understanding of the participants' behavior. Behavioral data is important, and we need to learn from the experience of completed trials. This is my last slide. In conclusion, I don't believe there are any magic bullets which will actually help to face up to the challenges that we have to deal with today. Improving trial efficiency is probably the best option that we've got. But we do need to learn from all that we can from the results of the completed and the current Phase 3 trials, particularly in regard to identifying unsuccessful interventions. Thank you very much.
Any clarifying questions for Dr. Nunn? I see Nance. Dr. Padian?
Is my question? Okay. One really quickly, a comment and then a question. And I think another
essential difference between prevention and treatment is adherence. And that is, if you know you're sick, your likelihood to take whatever it is obviously would differ than if you're well. A question about couples, about discordant couples, and that is, insofar as there's individual variation in susceptibility, I wondered what you thought about the likelihood of, unless you're getting the index partner with acute infection, getting couples where transmission, if it had occurred, would have occurred, and then you're sort of shooting yourself in the foot.
I suppose the answer to that is you won't know until we analyze the first of our studies. It's a very good point. It's not something we've really given a lot of thought to.
Dr. Van Dam?
Just a comment that the super DSMB has been proven in real life to work even at the last minute. The CS trials and two DSMBs came together within 3 days because it was a weekend in between, and we worked for both trials together with sharing the data, and we shared also with the trial of the NDP.
Thank you. I will now introduce our next speaker, who is Dr. Veronica Miller. She is the director of the Forum for Collaborative HIV Research in Washington, D.C. She's also professor of research at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. And she is going to be talking on what needs to be done to move prevention research forward.
Thank you. So I think as the last person in this panel, all I really have to do is take what everybody else has said and just reshuffle it a little bit. And maybe it will all sound somewhat different. But anyway, here we go. So I first of all wanted to acknowledge the Forum Biomedical Prevention Working Group, and I've given you the website for the information that will list all of the participants and all of the various presentations and work that went into putting out our first report that is also available on our website. So I guess the first statement that I would like to make is that effective research does require the effective translation of research results into implementation at the community level. And I hadn't really realized as I was preparing this talk how much this was going to be a theme of this conference here. So I think we've all been sort of singing the same song, maybe in different voices, but I think that's been very exciting to see that happening at this conference. So this is just sort of my kind of schematic view of the research cycle. We start with basic research here, whatever clinical trials, they provide results, they get confirmed. There needs to be some kind of acceptability at the community level to actually do that. And of course, some of these errors go back and forth. This is just very schematic. Anyway, at some point that then needs to be developed into policy, which then gets implemented, and that will hopefully provide effectiveness at the community level. And if that prevention really is effective at the implementation level, just as it was in the clinical trial stage, that will then build more confidence in the community regarding the research process and will support for the research. So this is really sort of the schematic. But you guys wrecked this. That doesn't work at all.
Warned, you did it.
There. But, you know, what I really want to point out that in this whole field of research, we're not really starting from zero at all. We have a lot of experience in prevention, both in the HIV field and in other fields. And there's a couple of here that use drugs, for example, prevention of mother-to-child transmission, preventing opportunistic infections or from malaria. I put this one in because I guess you could kind of compare that to something that, it's basically not a chemotherapeutic prevention, but a barrier method. And of course, we also have vaccines. So, part of the theme is that we always need to keep remembering the lessons we have already learned and try and maximize on those as we move forward in HIV. So this is my view of the current research landscape. I've changed the slide slightly from what we've used at our biomedical forum working group. So basically, once we get into policy development, and we do have a couple of, so this is basically the research timeline, and there's a couple of things that have already kind of come down this cascade and have been developed into policies. sort of needle exchange programs, condoms, and prevention of mother-to-child transmission, for example. And I'm just going to go through these fairly quickly. I mean, this is, you know, and I don't mean the spacing here to be anything that you should measure and figure out how many years this is going to take. But basically, prevention vaccines will be a somewhat longer time in coming. I think most people would agree with that. And maybe there's some third-generation microbicides, index valid partner treatment. But we already have some data available, for example, safety data on some second-generation microbicides and for some vaccine studies. We have data available for PrEP studies, for example, the safety data. And, of course, you know, we hope to have additional PrEP studies that are designed slightly different or use different drugs or combinations of drugs where data will be available later. HSV2, and then this is the one study that was actually stopped, male circumcision. We've heard a lot about the three studies that were so conclusive, and there was another study that was ongoing that was actually stopped. And I was looking at the effect of male circumcision in terms of preventing acquisition of HIV in females if the male was HIV positive. So that is, we have some data, or basically don't have much data available, but we did have a study going on that was stopped because it wasn't likely to show any major effect. And then we have those where we do have phase 3 data available. Not all the studies have been positive. So VaxGen, for example, is not likely to be converted into into policy. The CS study, the MIRA study, which we will hear more about at this meeting. And, of course, you know, one of the recent studies that has been is being developed into policy, of course, is the male circumcision for the protection of men in acquisition. What I wanted to illustrate here is that this does not happen in a vacuum. So when we talk about all of this prevention research landscape, it really happens in the presence of the various behavioral factors and how behavior influences the research and how research influences behavior. We have all the various sociocultural factors, for example, gender issues. I'm really just giving one example here. There's many more structural factors, such as access to school and how that determines what the individual person's risk is. In policy environment, for example, will the policy environment accept or not accept the research findings? And we have had many examples where positive research findings are not being accepted by the policymakers. But what's missing in the landscape is research on combination approaches. And I've just listed a couple of here, for example, microbicides and vaccines or HSV2 and male circumcision. And that data will be available later. So just a few thoughts regarding keeping effective research and how this will actually be moved forward. Well, I think one of the first things that does need to be sustainable. So we need funding and sustainability in funding. If we just have spurts of funding for every now and then, that's not really going to develop in any effective research agenda. So we need communication between the funders and the sponsors. We need better integration of the funding mechanisms. For example, and I'll get back to that later, too, program funding versus research streams, and really find work more on the question about how can we get most out of the research dollar. We also need to work much more on the sustainable of research sites, and I think that's already been alluded to in all of the talks before. You know, the real challenge of finding the right sites and being able to actually carry the studies through completion. And just my editorial comment here, turf wars will not build community support, because I think, again, this mantra that's been repeated by all the speakers already, that we really need to have community buy-in and community support. Cooperation, coordination, and collaboration. So we really need to work more on this. There are many, many cost-cutting issues between the different approaches in terms of the trials, and we need to find common solutions. But, basically cooperation, collaboration is a better business model than go it alone or silo approaches, and any person that is successful in business will tell you that. And in this situation, just one comment here, press is, you know, in airing things out in the press is not the best place for expert discourse. And I'm just mentioning this recent editorial that appeared in Nature, not because I want to highlight the controversy or draw it out again, but basically to really use that as an opportunity to talk about some of the lessons learned. And I think what that particular discussion showed is that the urgency of the HIV pandemic and the passions that are unleashed by that urgency are definitely real. Everybody is really very much concerned about doing the right thing as quickly as possible. But what it really does show is a need for a mechanism where we can really review the protocol discussions, and not that we should be shy about voicing different opinions, but it needs to be able to happen in a safe and collegial environment. And also, I think it highlighted the need for review process for prevention clinical trials that are transparent. So, just a few comments here. Good prevention research practice. Basically, our available resources, both in finances and in kinds of sites and patients we can enroll, et cetera, are really kind of at odds with the trial size requirements. And I think Ward really highlighted that very nicely, also Andrew Dunn. And it's just not just a matter of resources, because each prevention trial will impact on every other trial, and I think the prevention care, the package of prevention care really illustrates that. So there's in terms of both the changing standard of prevention care, but also just simply because the science is so interconnected. So none of these approaches really work totally independently of each other. So we really need to find a way to approach prevention research that's much more kind of an open dialogue with each other and finding ways to move forward that really mean win situations for everyone. In terms of the community importance, I think the community really needs to have confidence in the research, and we've seen many, many situations where that has happened. We've seen some where that wasn't happening, but now I think we have some very positive examples. And if the community doesn't trust what's going on, it's going to be very, very, you know, it's going to have a very negative effect. But the community also does need to be able to trust in the scientific rigor when choosing products for large-scale trials, that if they say, yes, we're really going to go into this with you, that really the scientists have done their homework in terms of what they're actually going to take into study. And so CABS alone will not constitute community ownership, and I've just listed some examples here of some of the circumcision trials, the Rakai study, and other very strong research programs, and different models that include strong research programs embedded in local centers of excellence. But these are just some examples of where community involvement was really made a priority, and I think it had really, really paid off. And just a few comments on research and policy. And again, that's been addressed, so I'll go through this quickly. So translation to the policy, once the positive results are available, is obviously necessary. And I also wanted to just highlight, because there was a very interesting talk that Don Smith gave at the IAS-ILF Symposium on Sunday that really talked, you know, had very good outline for how you plan for implementation. And just as an example of where this happens or doesn't happen, for example, the research that we have clearly demonstrates effective interventions to prevent mother-to-child transmission. Yet when we look at what's actually being implemented, and this comes from the Global Prevention Working Group, it is estimated that only 11% of HIV-infected pregnant women receive the necessary ARVs to reduce the risk of infection. So here's something where we have very, very clear evidence, and the policies have been developed, and yet they are not being implemented. And that's not just for MPCT, but for the rest. Just a few more comments about policymakers. So basically, this whole communication between researchers and policymakers, I think, is something that we need to work on further. And I'm just going to some examples where that clearly demonstrate that policymakers are not always being data-driven. A few comments on biomedical and behavioral research. And again, this has been addressed, so we can't really leave it out of the equation, although it's a very complex thing and it's sometimes difficult to figure out how that is going to work. But I think the bottom line is the problem with behaviors is that it happens or not, depending on whether we're talking about risk behavior or preventive behavior. So that's always going to be part of the equation. And then prevention and treatment go hand in hand. Now, this is one of Bob Grant's slides that I thought was just absolutely fantastic. When we talk all of that, what is the poor researcher to do? So there you're completely being overburdened with all the extra work. So just maybe as a way of solution, basically these things up here is what we think of traditionally in the research camp. And much of this down here really can be built into the program camp. And maybe if we do that effectively, we can actually develop the happy camper, so that the poor guy doesn't have to be so overburdened. Models of how we can... This is really wrecked.
Can you please advance the slide?
Different models of integrating programs and research. And then just basically the conclusion, let's not ignore the lessons that we have already learned. Let's work on translation of research into effective policy and implementation. Let's find ways to make sure that research in research sites are sustainable. Cooperation, coordination, collaboration, community ownership and confidence in the research are very important. And find better ways to integrate biomedical and behavioral research and treatment and prevention research.
Thank you. Thank you. So, if there are any quick clarifying questions for Veronica, and then we would like to move into a little bit more of a longer discussion or a discussion for all of the panelists that will be facilitated by Kim Dixon. And we may actually go a few minutes over because we started a bit late. Yes, in the back.
Hi, I'm Dr. Deepa Nadeem from PSI. This is my question to Dr. Miller. Dr. Miller, I am just trying to understand what you would imply by sustainability of research and the research sites. Can you please explain me what would that imply?
If I understood the question correctly, it was about sustainability of research sites.
Yeah, it's the sustainability of the research and the research sites that you have been talking about. If you can just further explain that point.
Yeah, so it's just basically the idea that if you're going to fly in every time you have a trial and then have to basically just set up a site from scratch, and that site then disappears when that particular trial is finished, but maybe another program has research going on where they could also maybe use that site. So basically trying to find ways to build up site capacity and get maximum use out of those sites that doesn't necessarily depend on just one particular agency or one particular program.
I just wanted to share, I think you have very correctly shown in your slides. I am a researcher, basically, so I would definitely feel burdened by the slide you have just shown, the amount of responsibility that's being projected for the researchers here. And we are basically into the behavioral research, and we are trying our best to bridge the gap between the research and the implementation part, like how do you explain the things to your programmers, and how do they then translate it into the implementation, the monitoring, the evaluation, and everything of that sort. So what I'm trying to say here is that as a researcher, I would be looking more for things which can help me in kind of defining my target segment, my respondent groups. How do I identify and measure the program indicators which I should be then tracking down from time to time? And then how do I then definitely enter into a research which gives feedback to the program people about effectiveness and the evaluation of the programs that we implement? So I would encourage and I would recommend that kind of discussion should be encouraged so that researchers like me can actually benefit from it. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. My task now is to try to facilitate a discussion on some of the emerging challenges that we have. So thanks to all the speakers. Can I ask that if you want to make a question or you want to make a comment or ask a question, if you could line up by the speakers, and please could you make your input short and succinct? And what I would like us to focus on really is taking from what the speakers have said around RCT evidence not being sufficient for policy formulation and effective research requiring translation of results into program implementation, that we look at some of the challenges and we try and address how we actually design our prevention research so that we can get it translated into policy and programs, but also to caution that we don't expect the researchers to do everything, even as we carry out the research. And so if we can try and open the discussion around some of those issues. Thank you very much. Can I take the first comment up there, please?
Yeah, I have one question. I would like to ask the question about male circumcision. As far as I see from the presentation, there were three trials done in Kenya, most probably. I just want to know that Was there any problem doing male circumcision to the adult population? And what was the barriers of how many people took it, or just a little bit deeper understanding of how it was accepted in the community?
Yeah. Just to summarize very quickly, tomorrow there'll be a plenary on that will address male circumcision. But to say that, no, there were not any real barriers, but also to point out that Professor Bob Bailey is in the audience, so I would suggest you grab him after this session and
raise
then
your hand, Bob,
if you don't mind, yes, and then he can tell you exactly what went on in Kenya. But there was also trials in Uganda and South Africa. Can I take, is that Judy, yeah? Hi. Can I just ask if Judy can give her question and we allow other people and then we'll come back to you. Thank you.
Well, Judy's actually going to make a comment and it's not directed to the panel, it's directed to the conference. Just to note that prevention research is much broader than randomized controlled trials in biomedical technologies. And I understand that the track for this conference was very focused on biomedical technologies, and I was invited to be part of that track committee, but part of my role was to remind others that there's a lot more to prevention research than just biomedical technologies and randomized controlled trials. That being said, I was struck, so my point is I'm sure your charge was limited to that, so this is not an accusation to the panel, but I think it is really important for us to remember that the field is much broader than that which is being discussed right here, in part because some of the challenges and limitations you all identified are precisely because we've been very narrow in our approach to prevention research, particularly with regard to the things that are most funded and accepted as being able to provide real evidence. And I think that the thing that struck me the most, and again, Veronica, I'm not going to pick on you, it was just your slide that sort of jumped out at me to help me make the point that when you had the boxes that showed the different biomedical technology trials and then round circles about social, cultural, and environmental factors that hover around these trials, as a sociologist and a social scientist, I would say those little circles ought to be the object of our research as much as the biomedical technologies and even individual behavior and behavior change. They're not handmaidens to or just sort of factors hovering about. I'm reminded, and I will be finished in just a second, I'm reminded of something that we all said very early in the field, and now it's kind of a chuckle moment, that if we actually spent more time and energy studying the behavioral change or behavior of decision makers and policy makers and attempted to change that, we might have a greater impact on the epidemic than focusing on individuals and communities we judge as more vulnerable. And it's if you think about it, it may sound a little goofy, but in fact it may be true that if we could change social attitudes and institutions, we could to mitigate stigma, to mitigate lack of access to health care, to do all these social things that everybody now recognizes as important, we might actually, to facilitate HIV prevention, we might actually have had a very significant impact. So my point is simply to say, let's not keep treating these things as if they're sort of handmaidens or off on the side or not relevant for prevention research. They ought really be a big part of ours.
Yeah, thank you very much for the important reminder, Judy. I think we've got it. Can I ask Brazy, because I think Brazy might want to emphasize that point, and then I'll come back to the lady up there.
Well, actually, I think Judy said perfectly, so I'm not even going to go there. I wanted to make perhaps a related point. I think it would be several of the speakers brought forward the issue of the timeline on research and the investments required before, during, and after. I wanted to propose, I don't know who the rapporteur is for this track, but Ward's slide about the pre, the during, and the post part of the prevention trials, I hope that goes into the final summary because I think it's really important, costing the whole package, planning for the whole package, not just for the slice in the middle. But I think it would be valuable to disaggregate what goes on, the issue of research versus program, who funds it, and the issue of quality. Because it's been a very public secret for a long time that in many low-resource settings, participating in a trial, in a study, is the best way to get services that are of a higher quality than you might get elsewhere. And I think where I'm going with this is that, particularly in the area of behavioral
intentions. I think we're on a journey to actually discover what high-quality prevention actually costs. I think we don't really know what high-quality behavioral interventions cost because we have been much more careful and, let's say, concrete about defining quality standards on the clinical interventions than in terms of the content and the basic requirements on the behavioral interventions. Often we get the best of both in the clinical trials, and then when we try to move into the programs afterwards, we haven't defined that the social and behavioral parts well enough to be able to roll it out into practice.
Yeah. Thank you. So we go back to the lady up there.
Thank you. I forgot to introduce myself. I'm Dr. Nahid Chaudhary from Bangladesh. I have the next question about microbicide gel, that if this is targeted and we get the chance to use it for the sex workers, because we know that they are the people who are more affected because the condom is not used by the clients, would it be ever be possible that they can only use the microbicide gel, or would it be there would be ethical problem telling them to use the gel without the condom?
Okay, thank you. We'll ask the speakers to note the question, and we can answer it at the end as we wrap up. Thank you.
Bridget here from the Australian Federation of AIDS Organisations. And the question that I wanted to ask was about partial efficacy. Specifically, how would you accurately and truthfully explain to a man, for example, who is considering circumcision as a prevention intervention, what exactly partial efficacy might mean to him in his particular circumstance?
Okay, I'll ask for some comment for the last two questions. Yes, and not just about male circumcision, because you can have partial efficacy with all the other products. So with the speakers, Quraysha?
The question from Dr. Chaudhary on use of gel without condoms. And I think the ethical issue is, are you talking about it in the context of a trial, or are you talking about it in the context of a gel that has already proven efficacy? So I think if you're talking about it in the context of a gel that already has proven efficacy, there isn't the ethical obligation to promote condoms, although it's very unlikely that if we do have a microbicide that is efficacious, it's likely to be partially efficacious, not 100% efficacious. So the messaging needs to be very carefully thought through, as with the male circumcision, that this is the level, and I can't predict or project what that is, whatever that level is, and you have to talk about other means and methods. It's important to remember, though, in the context of microbicide promotion, that it has a very specific niche market. It is for women who are unable to get their partners or their clients to use a condom. And so this would offer them some protection in that sort of context. So I don't think the messages are all so clean and clear-cut. I think we need to be looking at who the target population is and how best to do that messaging.
Any other comment on partial efficacy?
It's really interesting to try and sort of form a timeline on what we've learned about communicating partial effectiveness, really. Migrating from the contraceptive field into the HIV prevention field, we're doing this type of communicating all the time in terms of relative protection, in terms of choice of methods, but not perfect protection. I don't know what this is moving on. But at any rate, we are as part of the house, developing as clear messages as we can that will allow us to communicate to both participants, number one, and then in the real world, number two, that we're talking about procedures to lower risks, but frequently not eliminate risks. And perhaps by using multiple methods, you can lower those risks even more. This is sometimes a tough message to to, number one, communicate, and probably even a tougher message to act on at the individual level. But it needs to be reinforced.
I think you've framed the problem, but you haven't actually answered the question. What would you actually tell people?
You mean about male circumcision? Well, for number one, I'd turn to the person right behind you and say, what do you tell people? I would say that studies have shown that it reduces your risk of becoming infected by approximately 50 to 60%, and by making this decision to have that surgical procedure, you give yourself that degree of lower risk. You can further build on your ability to lower that risk by using condoms after you've had that surgical procedure. Is that, I don't know if that's clear enough for you.
It's a start.
It's a start, yes. And I think we have to understand that the issue of partial efficacy, partial effectiveness is a complicated one. And even in the reproductive health field, we've tried to communicate this and talk about dual protection, but we've got some experience from there. What I'll do is I'll take the last few comments. We've got three people on the floor, and I think they might even address this issue about partial effectiveness, etc. So we've got Bob, we've got Likeness, and Nancy, and then we'll sum up.
I'll actually duck the question you asked. I want to ask Ward. I was, needless to say, intrigued by your table that showed that male circumcision trials were relatively inexpensive. And I was wondering if there's anything behind that. So did you get any data on what contributes to the variation in the cost per endpoint or per participant? Why were the circumcision trials less expensive than some of the other trials, and why were some of the other trials so much more expensive? So did you get any of the factors that go behind those numbers?
There are a couple of speculations, but what would be really fun to do would be to get all of the investigators together actually at a round table to find the elements of what they used to make those cost projections, dissect those out, and then find out as best we can, comparing apples with apples, as to why that is. One of my speculations is that there was a heavy investment in the intervention up front, but there weren't as many visits and as much sort of participant interaction as might happen in terms of the other types of prevention trials. That's pure speculation. It would really be fun to get the individuals together to try and come up with a systematic approach to what goes into a prevention trial, especially now that there have been further expectations to it.
Okay, the chairs and the facilitators have been asked to wrap up. So I'll ask Likeness and Nancy to make very short comments, and then, I'm sorry, we have to close.
Yeah. On the same subject of male circumcision, did I just hear Dr. Kate's suggestion that we could include male circumcision as one of the interventions given in the standard of prevention?
Yes.
Okay, Nancy.
With regard to partial effectiveness or partial efficacy, I just think it's very important that we don't hold HIV prevention to a standard that pretty much doesn't exist. There are very few things in this world that are, as far as health goes, and public health, that really are 100% efficacious. And even seatbelts aren't. And I'm not saying that you can't have different levels of efficacy, but that is reality.
Thank you. That's a very lovely way to end this session. So I apologize we don't have more time for discussion, but we've been told to close. Thank you very much.